Okay, so on Friday we are going to have a makeup class. This will be basically continuation of today's class. So when we come back on Monday, that would be continuation of Friday's class. So I mean, there was only one person who said, one registered student who said they can't attend. So I'm going to go ahead and hold it at that time. And as I said, the reason I'm doing it is that the week after, I would not be here at all for two classes. So next week I'll be here, but the week after, I won't be here for two classes. And so I will go ahead and make up one class now, and then I'll make up the other class sometime when I come back. Okay. And then I'll get you probably, hopefully you will have started, some of you started writing down your ideas for Kartik, Loretta, Jeff, Raul, and Marcos have apparently put what they're going to read about. I'm going to try and get back to you on these. My hope is that, in fact, you will spend a significant amount of time the week. You won't have any classes. Not that you do a lot when there is classes, but, you know, you have even that extra hour available. So you can actually spend time thinking about what you're going to do for that presentation thing. And I'm also going to start giving you some ideas about, I think there'll also be sort of a deadline coming up, you have to start thinking about what project you're going to do. Okay, those are the things that I haven't yet given a deadline for that. This one, make sure that you have this written up. Those of you who have not given the information, make sure you do by Monday, okay, before Monday's class. Okay. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't do classical search today in this class, right?
No, yeah, we just touched upon it. Mm-hmm. They are sort of on deep into those topics. So I wanted to choose a topic on machine learning.
Yeah, that's fine.
Right. So the thing is, like, and I also wanted to know how much of that will be covered, how much time will be devoted.
As I said, the maximum I basically point out, I mean, is the 571. Let's see, what did I say? I just want to be consistent. Course overview. Okay. So these are the things that I know I would be doing, and maybe more, but if you look at these, relational and first order probabilistic reasoning techniques, learning would be covered there once. Okay. And then knowledge based learning, reinforcement learning would be covered there once. Okay. But, you know, it's not a machine learning course. It's not a planning course, it's not any of these single topic courses. So we would be doing a cross section. And you know, the papers you read can go into specific topics, that should be fine.
The paper in the conference goes very specifically deep into one topic to discuss.
That's fine.
So like this about, they have a specific task technique to solve it.
That's fine. Now again, as I said, write this down and then I can talk to you about whether, in fact, one thing that I have to make you guys realize is it's probably not the quantity but the quality of your understanding that matters. You know, the easier one to do is to write, you know, read seven papers and say one word each about all seven papers, okay, and basically saying just repeat what they said in the abstract. To actually understand a single paper in the conference proceedings, you know, you need to go back and, you know, read the paper that paper is talking about, which are available somewhere else. Okay? And, you know, the usual thing is that I would actually prefer that people pick one paper that they really like and are able to explain it at a level that you can teach people. That's the whole point of presentation, right? In the sense that, and you know, it's one thing just reading and saying, yeah, that sort of makes sense. But why are they doing what they're doing? To understand that, you need to go back to their references, read the right ones, and explain why they made the design choices they made. And this is a skill that you learn, that you have to learn at some point of time. And so I actually prefer people picking one paper that they really seem to like, rather than 8 papers or 10 papers, you know. That's just the tip of the iceberg. It's even less than the tip of the iceberg. And then to understand that 1 6-page paper, you know, you need to provide background. Okay? So, you know, from what you're telling me, it's possible that you liked one paper, but then in trying to make sense of it, you would have to understand, you know, a reasonable number of papers, not in Nichkai 2009 proceedings, but the ones outside of that. Okay? Other questions? This basically, once if you wrote this down, yeah, then you made one step. Then I need to get back to you.
The project,
I would probably make it sort of due by the time I come back. So you'll have some time, but start thinking about it. Normally, if you pick a paper as well as a project in similar areas, that would be better for you. Okay. Again, you know, the thing is, I actually will try to send you an article that you can read if you come to my office, and you know, if I'm not there, you can read it on my door about graduate study. Okay. The point about graduate study is that at some level it's an apprenticeship. Okay. In the sense that there's no textbook, you just don't read the textbooks and be done with it. There's a part of it that I'm doing in this class, but a part is being able to realize, you know, what is interesting in the literature to you, and then how to extend it in some interesting way. And there are not, you know, there are some generic tricks I can talk about, but there is nothing that I can teach other than one-on-one, you know. So thankfully we only have 17, and so I'm hoping that half of you would probably not care, and so the other half who do care, I will have time to spend. I'm not saying half of you should not care, but statistics say that half of you won't care as to what you're doing, right? But I think I can handle it if, in fact, people ask me specific questions on, you know, I got interested in this, what else do you think I should read? They're talking about these 8 papers, which should I read? Especially if it is in areas that is related to me. And I can also kind of tell you, if you have a couple of ideas for your term project, whether or not it's feasible, I can give you that idea because I have some experience as to what can be done and can't be done. I'm not foolproof, but you know, I'm somewhat older than you guys in this thing, right? So that's the only thing I can say. I mean, you know, I think it's in a way, at some point of time, textbooks only get you so far, and then you just really have to figure out what's going on in the area, and that's what graduate study is supposed to do, help you with. And you know, I'm trying to do half and half. You know, more than half of it I'll be speaking and with specific readings. But at least part of it, you would have to do your own thing. Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Okay. So in today's class, I am actually going to just complete one topic that I did not get to complete last time from the Beyond Classical Search that's been going beyond its allotted time. Which is online search, and then shift into planning in belief space, which, you know, I've been talking about various aspects of it. Today, mostly what we'll do in planning in belief space is talk about the representation, which we started talking about last time, talk about what does it mean to do progression and regression with no observability, I mean, you know, when there is no observation actions at all, and how to do that when you have observation actions. And then hopefully, after that comes how to provide heuristics for that. Okay, so all of this is some sense being done already in the state level, but now we'll try to do it at the factored level. By the way, we use the terminology atomic, propositional, relational, and first order, right? But the propositional in the literature, it's oftentimes also called factored representation. Factored representation means the state is described in terms of some features which can take some values. Okay. Atomic means that state is a black box, it's an indivisible entity. you don't think about the structure of the statement itself. Okay, so that's the basic idea. So we will talk about how to do essentially the search as well as heuristics with representations that are typically used in planning, which are basically factored representations. Okay, so in terms of the online search, again, I'm assuming you read the chapter, and stop me if you have specific advanced questions than what I'm talking about. So the main thing, of course, about online search is you are interleaving thinking and doing. Okay, so the assumption in classical search is you completely do the thinking upfront, make an entire solution and start executing it. That made complete sense anyway in the context of deterministic and static worlds. Deterministic, static worlds, and especially if they're also, and in fact, once you are deterministic and static, and if the initial state is fully observable, then there is really no advantage of doing a little. Doing a little thinking and doing some execution and again doing little thinking. Because what's the big deal? There's no actual deadline. Nobody is pushing you to do something. Do you understand what I'm saying? So, but on the other hand, once those assumptions are gone, so it's no longer deterministic, no longer fully observable, and no longer static. If any of these assumptions are gone, then there are actually good reasons to interleave thinking and execution, right? So the most obvious reason to do thinking and execution, interleave thinking and execution, is loss of static assumption. If the world doesn't stop when you're thinking, you better do something, you know. Because by the time you're done with the thinking, the usual example of that is trying to cross, you know, University Avenue or rural road, and you're trying to think of what's the best way to cross the road. And, you know, if you're suddenly out in the middle of the road and you're trying to decide what's the best half of the second half of the path, if you think too long, you might get run over. Okay? So, but in general, once there are additional agents, then you may not actually have the ability to continue thinking, and so you need to find some way of, there is this idea called deliberation scheduling. Which is, you need to schedule how much thinking to do. Okay, this is open with a big O problem. Okay, if I knew the answer to it, you know, if we know the answers to it, we will be much better off in life. How much thinking to do before you actually make a decision? Okay, but the big issue is, while you may not know exactly how much thinking to do before you do the action, it's clear that you do have to sometimes start doing action while the thinking is not complete. Even if you don't have the optimal solution for deciding exactly how much thinking to do before you do first action, it is completely clear that you do have to interleave. So, for example, in some cases, right, such as chess, right? Chess is obviously a non-static game. I mean, chess with just yourself is no fun. But you know, if you have an opponent, they have rules normally. Like, for example, for each move, you only have this much time. And if you don't make a move in that time, then essentially, you know, you're forfeiting. Right, so there it's actually easy. So you know, and in fact, in particular, if you don't get any points for making a move earlier, so for example, making a move before the clock is over, then you want to just max out up until the clock and then make a move. But you haven't figured out how to win the game yet. You just made one move. Okay, if you really don't care about the fact that the world is not static. I mean, if you want to assume the world is static, then you really should have a nice conditional strategy for chess, right? It's just do this, I mean, upfront, even before, you just go ahead and make a huge, big conditional strategy, and then you start executing. So when as soon as your opponent makes a move, you right away look up and say, oh yeah, if this is the state, then I am supposed to do this. State is defined in terms of, you know, the current state of the board after your opponent also had made a move. Right? Now, most of the time, why don't we do that? It's a huge search space. It's a huge search space. So, an interesting point is that while chess game is not static, it's dynamic in a very systematic way. Okay, like it's not like while you are thinking somebody is going to drop a big weight on your head, right? And there are very straightforward rules that, you know, the players have to obey. And so, in theory at least, you could have done a conditional strategy up front. The reason you don't choose to do it is because you just, there are not enough computational resources in the world to do that. That brings you that basically in saying this, I have sort of separated two different motivations for online search. I hope you understood that. Okay? One motivation for online search is essentially that you just, so when you are doing online search with the knowledge of the transition model, so you do know the transition model in the case of chess. You know, if you do this, then you know what are all the things that the other player can do. So you could actually draw an entire tree. In fact, you have done that in min-max search. Okay, so why use min-max search to just find out the first move? Why not make an entire conditional strategy? The reason is you do not want to plan for all contingencies. Okay, and it's too costly to do so. And so in these cases, if you're doing online search, it's basically because of computational resources or because you're lazy. You don't want to think all the way. Okay, and in those cases, you can compare your performance to a search strategy which takes the entire model and uses it. And then you can talk about competitive ratio. How well do you do with respect to a model which does all its thinking up front? Okay. Now, the interesting point about online search is, you know, I'll show another slide after this, but online search really is a big hammer that can be used to hit many, many different nails which have really nothing to do with each other. Okay. You can do online search. I like this quote. I don't know. I think one of my friends, my son's teachers were saying this. Adventure is just a failure to plan. You know, people who are lazy, like I'm going to go to Greece next week, right? So I could say, I'm just going to have adventure. That basically means I'm so lazy to plan ahead as to where I'm staying, what I'm seeing, that I'll wing it when I go there. Do you understand what I'm saying? So it's like a sort of a CPU laziness or intellectual laziness. Okay, so when you start talking about online search, you could say, well, I would not do any thinking up front. I'll just do a little thinking and do something and then wait for, you know, what the world does. And then I'll figure out what else to do. Now, when you do that, you can easily get yourself into suboptimal performances. Notice that in this particular case, there is a full transition model available. Okay, it may be stochastic, but it's available. And I could have used it. And I chose not to. And so I have to, it's reasonable for you to compare me to somebody, you know, so I go off without much of a thinking at all, and, you know, I'll have some amount of fun in Greece, only get arrested a couple of times, and so on and so forth. And somebody else, you know, does a lot more thinking up front and had a different kind of a fun. It's reasonable for you to compare, you know, the amount of fun they had to the amount of fun I had. Okay, and that would be competitive ratio. Okay, and so in general, when all online search is saying is combine, interleave execution and search, but how much, I'm sorry, yeah, execution and search, or search is thinking and execution is actually working in the world. And how much of thinking you do before you do the first action is basically up for grabs. Okay, those of you who remember the min-max search, right, you could do n-ply search to figure out the first move. The deeper you go, the more likely it is the case that the move that you pick is actually the best move. Okay? But then the deeper you go, the more time you need to actually go deeper. So in fact, you know, we remember you talked about the difference between the fact, I forget the exact numbers, but you know, 3-4 ply deep is what more or less normal people do. And if you do 8-9 ply, Then basically a ply essentially is I do this, that's one ply, then my opponent gets to make a decision, second ply, and then I get to do something, my opponent gets to do something. The deeper I go in this, you know, I, my opponent, and then evaluate the nodes at the bottom level, propagate the values up and decide which action to do, the deeper I go, the more effective my decision is going to be. Okay, and we know that, in fact, just going a few extra ply is the difference between master's level chess and the chess that you and I play. I mean, maybe not you, but at least I play. Okay, and so basically it's just a question of, it becomes quite quite hard quite fast if you want to try and get any kind of guarantees as to optimality of the decision you're making. So first of all, there's a spectrum. That's all I want you to understand in that case. Now, the second case where online search is needed is I have no model. So this is, I have the model. It just so happens that the model is not deterministic. It's not observable. It's not static. Or some subset of assumptions being violated. The other case is I have no model. I have no idea what will happen. Okay? In that case, online search is pretty much the only thing you can do, because you actually have to do an action and then see what happens and then see whether or not you like the outcome, and then you figure out whether or not it's a game worth playing. That's what kids are doing all the time, right? I mean, they think, you know, if it's a red thing, it looks pleasing to the eyes. Now, why does, you know, red thing look pleasing to the eyes? That's the question of how our reward wires, or, you know, reward circuits are wired up. And I did mention that, you know, it's amazing how much we are wired up already to like certain kinds of, I mean, you know, I already told you about the rotten egg smell. The other thing that seems to be like across cultures is grating sound, right? I mean, if I do like this on a thing, I just, even showing that, most people say, why? You know, what's the reason? And, you know, it's something that we just all seem to have, and it's wired in for us. You know, it's not a particularly bad sound. I mean, there are bombs, I would say, a bigger bad sound, but we got so used to that for Hollywood movies that we really hate only the grating sound. Okay. So the point is that there is a reward model that's already sort of built in for kids, and then they're using that reward model and they're doing actions without knowing what their consequences would be. And then they'll figure out whether or not they like the consequences. Okay, whether or not you like the consequences, if it's paining, you didn't like it. If they didn't pain, maybe it's okay. You see what I'm saying? So now, in that particular case, search is the only way. I mean, so there actually the connection between think, you know, search and execution is much more interesting, because in the beginning, the children, you know, are your autonomous agent, might only have a partial model of the world. You know some of the effects of the action. Okay, and you know names of other actions. Like, for example, kids know that, you know, they have figured out when they were small that they have, first of all, it said that in the beginning kids don't even differentiate between their body and the rest of the world. They think entire world is connected to them, right? And then after a while they realize that they have limbs, they have control over their limbs. Now, so once you have control over your limbs, at least you know some of the actions you can do. I understand you don't know certain other actions, such as, you know, how to deposit money into a checking account when you are 1 year old. That's an action that we know how to do, but they know some of the actions. Many more actions they know than they know the models for those actions. Do you understand what I'm saying? So they know the name of the action, but you have no clue what happens if you do this in this particular scenario. And what they do is they'll keep trying this, trying this, trying this until they learn the model. And to make sure that we actually have kids left over after all these trials, we stabilize the environment. We make sure that there are no very red-hot stuffs that are looking inviting, so that they can put their hand and figure out whether or not it's a good thing to do. Okay, so we stabilize the environment. But otherwise, they'll do everything that is possible to do and figure out whether they liked it or not. And in doing so, they are building up the models of the actions. They're building up models of the actions. Okay, and what's interesting then is in that kind of an online search, you can see that you start with a null model, which is actually not true. Even children have a small model epsilon. Okay, And then as they act in the world, the model is being expanded. They're learning both good and bad models. When you're learning models, you can get wrong models, for example, because nobody tells them whether their understanding is the right way, you know, the right effect of the action. They just saw it coming. So they may do 3-4 actions, for example, and then they get a sensation of pain. Which is the action that's bad? This is a classic credit blame assignment problem, you know, and if you basically at the end of these 4 actions something bad happened to you, is it the last action that caused the pain? Is it that there is something that you did in the beginning which in conjunction with what you did in the end caused you the pain? And they make reasonable assumptions, they make essentially reasonable, you know, biases and learn things, and then they will have to figure out that that model could be wrong. But as long as they have a model, they will use the model. Okay? And so after you have a partial model, a child then tries to use that to figure out what to do next. But then children being children, they would also try not to follow the model. Try a bunch of actions for whom they don't know the effects. If children did not do it, they won't come to graduate school. They won't actually even get to normal school because we could not teach them everything about the world. You know, they have to try out, you know, things other than the ones for which they know the, you know, effects. Okay, that path actually, whatever I just talked to you here, it brings you into this idea called reinforcement learning, which is a technical field we'll talk about in this class. That's one of the learning topics we will talk about. So in reinforcement learning, you start with a partial model of the transition matrix. The partial could be empty. Okay? And then the agent essentially decides, using the model, it decides an action to do. It does the action in the world, feels the reward. Okay? And then once it felt the reward, then it can update its model. Say this action seems, in this state I seem to get bad rewards, in this state I seem to get positive rewards. And then next time around when it needs to decide what action to do, it can use that partial model, or with some probability it should use the partial model and another probability it should try states for which it doesn't know the rewards, or try actions for which it doesn't know the value. That basically in reinforcement learning is called exploration, exploitation, trade-off. Okay, and all of you are, especially in graduate school, you're doing that. I mean, you can exploit the knowledge that you got in the elementary school, you know, or high school. There are some bunches of jobs that you can do with just that knowledge. And you have decided to explore more, and so you get to college, and then you decide to explore some more, you get to graduate school. Now, whether or not you're making the right exploration exploitation trade-off is not for me to comment on. I hope you'll choose to make this way because I would have somebody to teach to, but there is a question as to whether it's an optimal exploration exploitation trade-off. Okay, there are interesting ways in which, you know, when we look at reinforcement learning, we can make technical statements about whether or not, I mean, everybody knows, for example, that if you don't do any exploration at all, then even asymptotically, you will never have optimality. Whereas as soon as you start doing some exploration, that is epsilon probability, you do actions that are whose effects are not already completely understood, you have asymptotic probability is non-zero that you will reach optimum. You'll get the optimal reward. Optimal. Now, when I say that, of course, you have to talk in the context of MDPs, which is what we will do. And so that's the optimal cumulative reward you will wind up getting. If you, as long as you do exploration. Now, how much exploration to do is a more interesting question. Okay, but that's kind of, all of that comes in the context of online search with respect to absence of the transition model. Now, one question that you can ask is there really a difference between not knowing what an action does and knowing that the action might do one of 5 different things? So, when I toss a coin, do I have a model for what happens or not? As long as, so the point is, you have to, I mean, as long as it's not a problem, for, you know, it's not a question for you, you are in good shape. Okay. The difference in tossing a coin versus, oh, this looks like a nice shiny switch, let me touch it on, you know, let me press it and see what happens. They're completely different. In the first case, I know that at best, it'll be heads or tails. And in the second case, there's a nice, shiny switch, and I press it, I don't know, some small island might just go off. Right? I have no clue. Or a light might come on. Now, how many times have you pressed switches without knowing what the heck they do? A whole bunch of times, otherwise we won't be here. I mean, some of those people who, you know, did bad things are not here, but thankfully, enough of us were doing that we, you know, explored the world. Okay, so in the textbook, actually, I don't remember whether it's in this chapter or not, there is this distinction made between bounded versus unbounded indeterminacy. I mean, it's a nice jargon term, but it's essentially saying, if you don't even know what can happen, right, that basically means that you have no model of the action. Now, of course, if you live in a finite and small enough world where a total number of states are only 256, not knowing what happens is really not knowing which of the 255 256 states would you get to after you doing this action. Okay, that might look like something that you can live with. So you can write that particular action as an uncertain action with 256 possible outcomes. Okay, so it is possible if the model is, even if you don't know the actions model, if you know a little about it, you might sometimes be able to write an unknown action into a stochastic action. But that's not always possible. And furthermore, in fact, not knowing, the other bigger thing is, you know, in the way we are talking about, it looks as if, as long as the number of outcomes are finite, number of states are finite, you might want to just convert it into an uncertain outcome action. But if you start talking about stochastic models, then it's not just enough to say what states might happen, but you need to also give the probability that those states might happen. That's an extra piece of information. You may not know that. Okay? So, in general, this side of the online search makes you think very significantly about not knowing the model and not being sure that the model is complete. Whereas on this side, it's just search is being done with respect to a given model. You chose not to use the whole model because you're feeling lazy. Okay? As against here, there is nothing. How much I was thinking I do, it's not going to, I mean, if I was a kid, I can think, I can sleep, you know, 10 extra hours, but it's not going to help me figure out what's my optimal action because I have no clue what actions do. I have to do a few and build my partial model. Okay, so those are very different reasons for online search. And when you are doing especially this, in fact, in general, it's true for all online search, the online search algorithms, if you're talking about providing search algorithms in online search, this is, certain types of approaches just do not work for online search. For example, you cannot really do A-star search with respect to online search, okay? Which is, you did a bunch of actions and you found yourself here, in this state of the world, you're standing here. You can't just say, hey, maybe I should have been in Tucson right about now. Let me just be in Tucson right now. I can do that if I'm searching in my head. Okay, so A-star is violently changing its paths. It's taking one node, which is at the tip of this branch, and then, hey, this is not as good an F value. This one looks more shiny, so I'll take that. So that's like being in Tucson and going forward in Tucson. But that's thinking. In execution, you are now stuck here. If you want to try what happens in Tucson, now you have to go from here to Tucson. And then you get to do this, the other part. Do you understand what I'm saying? So in general, online search strategies tend to have depth first or single path nature to them. It's not because you can't do A star search, you can, but it's useless. Okay, because how are you going to change your path? To get from one branch to another branch, you actually now have to do an actual execution in the real world. Okay, and that also means that if you did not plan well, right, for example, I have these two islands and I'm trying to decide, you know, which island to go to, and, you know, I'll toss a coin, I'll pick this island, you know, my Greek island, you know, metaphor, and I go to the wrong island, right, and then all sorts of fun is happening in that other island. Where am I going to do? I mean, maybe the only ship for that day has dropped me off here and will come back day after tomorrow. So now I just get to watch it from here. Whereas if I thought a little bit more, did some more, you know, Googling and figured out where is the most funnest island. And by the way, I'm not doing any of this. This is just totally hypothetical. I'll be doing real research when I go off next week after next. But the point is, if I did more planning, I might have been in the right island to begin with. And once I got to that, I can do some search there. You know, which restaurant will I eat in the island is something I can do. But I can't change the island because I've already dropped in that. Whereas in the search time, I can do that. You know, this is something, it's very obvious to you in one sense, but not obvious at all to you in another sense. You know, I mean, for some of the people, they think all search algorithms are applicable in all cases, and, you know, it doesn't make any sense. You really do need depth first, or, for example, hill climbing is another strategy that would work for online search. Okay. Now, of course, if you are doing hill climbing, one interesting hill climbing. So actually, if you remember, the hill climbing metaphor came because of mountaineers climbing the hills. They do real hill climbing, and they don't do hill climbing search. They do hill climbing online search. Do you understand what I'm saying? If you made a wrong turn in a fork, then you are suddenly stuck on this very bad ridge, and all the people are going up, you know, to the Everest singing song somewhere there. But there's a nice big crevasse there. You can't cross. It's too late. So now the only way you can get there is come all the way down and go all the way up. Now, we knew that hill climbing was asymptotically inoptimal, remember, when we talked about hill climbing? And one idea for making hill climbing optimal was random restart. Right? That means, I don't like where I'm going, I'll just randomly pick one of the states in the world and start doing search again from there. That obviously does not make sense when you're doing hill climbing as online search, unless you can randomly materialize and dematerialize at different points on Mount Everest. What?
That would point your wind.
Yeah. So, now of course, while random restart won't work for hill climbing, I mean, this is again connection to stuff that you know. I mean, you know hill climbing, you know random restart, which works as long as it's a search. But random walk would be something that you can do with respect to online hill climbing. So the idea is, with some probability, you do the action that increases your merit or your elevation, and with some non-zero probability, you also do the action that reduces your elevation. If you do this, one day you will reach the top of Everest if you are not frostbitten by then. Right? Because even after going to the top of Everest, you would, you know, with some probability wind up taking an action. I mean, the top of like Lhotse or something, which is this almost as tall as Everest, which, you know, from base camp, it looks almost as imposing as Everest, but it's actually much less in height. And so if you got stuck on Lhotse's top, then, you know, you won't get stuck because, you know, with some probability you'll start coming down and then going up the other mountain. And so, asymptotically, you have optimality just because you have random walk. That was another, you know, hill climbing we did. One other thing that you can do in online search, especially in the context of online search with no model, is when you reach a state, you feel the reward of that state. And when you feel the reward of that state, you remember. If you remember, you built a model. Do you understand what I'm saying? And in fact, this LRTA star agent is the kind of agent where it might say that Here is an interesting scenario. You may not know, suppose I told you the following kind of interesting scenario. You went into a room, I'll tell you that you will be in this room, there will be some obstacles. I won't tell you where the obstacles would be. Okay? And you would need to reach this corner. And, you know, I'll tell you what your coordinates are in this room. But you don't know what obstacles would be until the actual game execution starts. That's a reasonable, you know, game. And it can happen in some cases where you know some parts of the model. You know that there will be, wherever you go, there will be floors. You know, wherever in the world you go, there will be floors. So you'll be able to stand up at least. But there are many other actions that for which you don't know. You know, for example, whether or not certain steps you can take depends on whether or not there's an obstacle there. Right? So in this model, what happens is you do not know for any given state how far is it from the goal state. Okay? If I had given you the configuration of the obstacles up front, then at least at the knowledge level, you know all the information to figure out for each of the states, each of the points in this grid, exactly how far they are from the goal state. You may decide not to do it because that will take longer than just finding a path from where you are to the corner. Okay, so A star basically uses an estimate heuristic such as straight line distance, but it could actually have, you know, if you have the full model, you could actually figure out the exact distance from any point to the goal state. Come online search, when you don't know the model, you don't know how many obstacles are there and where they will be placed, you no longer can find the exact distances from any point to the goal state. But can you use the straight line distance heuristic as an underestimate? Yes or no? Yes. Unless you have any reason to believe that when you get into this room, Euclidean geometry fails, right? Straight line distance is still an under approximation to the true distance. So you can always use straight line distance as a heuristic. So for every node, you can essentially say, I know the h values of this node. Okay? And similarly, so if I'm here and if I have this node, I mean this particular state here, I know the h value because of the straight line distance. I also know the g value estimate because of the straight line distance. So I will know the f value estimate for everybody up front. They are pretty bad, but they're there. And then when I actually get to this state, if I remembered how I came, I have a better idea of the G value. Okay? And so I can change my estimates on the nodes. That's exactly what LRTA started out. It changes its estimates during the search. Now the interesting question, during the execution, the interesting point to understand about LRTA star search is if you don't have the model, the only way you can improve the estimate is actually by executing in the world. If you have the model, you can improve the estimate either by thinking longer or executing. But if you don't have the model, the only way you can increase the estimate is by actually executing. Yes?
So we discussed this question also, what if we have no way of estimating the distance to the goal?
Then you can say all of them are zeros. If you are an optimist. Or infinities, if you are a pessimist.
So then how the search progresses?
Well, you know, if you say infinities, then there is no search. So you are one of these really lazy kids. You say, getting out of my crib, very dangerous. Let me just hang around here. And then that kid is still in the crib. You know, maybe you would say that's the right thing for kids. You know, this is not a good place to be in. But you got out of the crib. You didn't know the estimate. You have no clue when you got out of the crib what is the estimate of, you know, goodness of that state. So you made an optimistic estimate of some sort. And then when you did find that, you know, when you did learn that that state that you got into was actually quite bad, you change your estimate for that state. Okay? So one way of understanding what's going on, in fact, when we get to the MDP, I mean, those of you who already remember MDPs will, you know, it makes a lot of sense, that you can just say that in the context of Markov addition processes, having a model and not having a model, the difference is, in one case you have this transition matrix with probabilities. In the other case, either there is no probabilities or you don't believe the probabilities. Okay? And in both cases, whether you have the model or not have the model, the goal of Markov addition processes is to find the optimal value function. What's the value function? In the deterministic case, if you think of deterministic MDPs, optimal value function is the H star, which is the perfect heuristic. Okay? So you can estimate, but then you learn the actual values as you go on. One of the things, again, you know, some of these I'll get back to, much of what I did in the last three classes, I believe, is foreshadow where we would be going without really having algorithms. But we will have algorithms when we get there. When we come back to reinforcement learning again, one of the interesting things in you know, where you do this in the reinforcement learning is, should you learn the value function, which is telling you for each state what is its true value, or you know, if you think in terms of deterministic scenarios, what is its true F value? Okay? Or should you run the value of the actions with respect to states, which would be called Q learning? How many of you have heard the word Q learning? Okay, only one. Okay, I assume a lot more people may have heard. But, you know, if you did hear, then that's the difference. You know, Q learning, the, you know, basically tries to learn the value of doing an action A, optimal value of doing an action A in state S. If I give you all the Q values for every state and every action, then I argue, if I give you the optimal Q values for every state and every action, then I argue that I have given you the V star F. Right? Because the value of a state, for those, you know, again, remember the MDPs, value of a state is the value, is related to the value of the optimal action that you can do from that state. The difference is, this first tries to learn the entire value model and then tries to use it. This sort of learns pieces of it in a different way. It learns the Q values. And both cases, they can be partial. I may know the Q values for sure for some model, some actions, and may have no idea at all for the other actions. Okay? Anyway, okay, so I think we actually talked about this already. Online search is a hammer that can hit many nails. If you have no model, you will need to do online search. Yes, sir?
Going back to the Q stars.
Yes.
How do you know you're not finding this? You know, you have the Q stars for every state and every action for that state.
Mm-hmm.
How do you know that's not just the local optima at?
No, the Q star means it's the optimal value.
For that state, for a given
yeah.
state. How do you know for the overall value to the goal?
So the interesting thing is actually, I mean, whatever discussion I did on MDPs made a lot more sense to those people. I mean, I hope made a lot more sense to those people who already did MDPs last year, and makes much less sense to people who haven't thought about it. You know, MDP is actually a much more generalized version of normal search. Okay, so for example, the answer to your question is, if I give you Q star FA, then I am telling you what is, in terms of the search metaphor with a single goal state, okay, I am telling you what, after I do action A from this state S, exactly how much is the minimal distance from the new state that I will get to the goal state. Do you understand what I'm saying? So in a way, I'm giving you part of the perfect heuristic. It turns out that the MDP model actually is much more general. We will get to that next week, hopefully. And, you know, because I think I have to repeat that one thing, even though I did it in 471. Because many people probably didn't do MDPs in 471. And in an MDP, essentially, you don't need to talk about goal states at all. You can say every state gives you some reward. And it's even feasible to go back to that state and get more of that same reward. That's the entire drug addiction for you. Right? I mean, like, it's not, in sometimes, you know, you only get to get the reward once. You know, so for example, if you go to your friend's birthday party, they'll allow you to take your ice cream only once. You know, even though it's good, you can't stand back in the line. You know, whereas in a free country with enough syringes to go around, you can do the drugs any number of times. Okay, and so you repeatedly collect rewards. Okay, so and each state gives you an immediate reward. And an MDP policy is optimal if in fact it can guarantee that the behavior starting from that state, if you start from a state and follow the MDP policy, then you would get the optimal cumulative reward. Okay? But you know, in the context of just deterministic search, think of Q star S A as H star S A. Normally you think of H star with respect to S, right? That's the H star value of a single state. That is V star in MDP terminology. If you consider a new function called, let's say, H hat star S A, it tells you, if you start from state S, do an action A, then after that action A, exactly how far are you from the goal state, in the minimal distance to the goal state. Now if I give you this, so here is a state, and if you do action A, you are 5 away from the goal state, action B, you are 3 away, action C, you are 2 away, and these are the only actions. Then you know the value of this state. But if I didn't tell you that these are the only actions, then you don't know the value of the state. And yet you know the Q values of the state. So it makes a sense to think in terms of Q values rather than just the value function in cases where you don't even know what actions are available, for example, which is, for example, the case for kids. They don't even know what are all the actions that can be done. But among the actions, the best will wind up being the best achievable value. Okay. So if you have no model, then you will need online search, since only by exploring you can figure out the model. And as soon as you learn part of that model, you are stuck with the exploration exploitation straight up. That's what I was explaining. Okay. But if you have a model but you're too lazy to use it, you need online search again. Okay. And limited contingency planning, that means there are many actions which can have many possible outcomes. You know the probabilities. But how many contingencies are you going to take care of? Right, I live in a real world, so when I'm trying to go from here to home, every action I do can have one reasonably intended effect and possible other possible effects with some probabilities. Am I going to take care of all those probabilities and, you know, make alternative plans if I get stuck there? If I do that, I'll have a full contingent plan. Okay, if I don't, then I have a just single plan assuming that the world works as advertised. If I do somewhere in between, I have a limited contingency plan. I took care of some of the bad contingencies that can happen, but left open the other. Okay, again, to do that, in essence, you're doing online search. So you start doing a mainline plan, and if it starts going wrong, and if you can sense that it went wrong, then you now have a new planning problem. How to get back onto the road to continue going where you need to go. You know, you can't plan for detours up front, right? So, but you kind of get onto the road, and then, I mean, if you actually saw, for example, that, you know, rural road would be closed over the weekend, then you can use that. But if you didn't, then it's okay if you just made a plan assuming rural road would be open, or, you know, 360 would be open, and then when you get there, there's a detour, and then you replan at that point of time. That's, you know, in that case, I can say, you know, you being foolish, you could have called up before going. Call this whatever 511 number and find out, you know, what roads are all closed. And you were lazy. You didn't want to waste that time. And, you know, in fact, you can even say that my laziness is rational. Because the last 10,000 times I called this damn number, 9,999 times they said, yeah, fine. So it's like I'm wasting, you know, 15 precious seconds of my life. And maybe, you know, if there's whole times, then, you know, even more than that. Calling this number only to find that the road is fine anyway. So there is sensing cost. So I'll go ahead, not sense, get stuck, and then replan at that point of time. Okay. One other thing, by the way, if you want to not mind getting stuck, for online search to work, it better be the case that the domain is ergodic. It's a nice big word. How many people know what ergodic means? Yes, sir. There is a non-zero probability of reaching any state from any other state. That's ergodicity. Okay, what that basically means is you can't paint yourself into a really bad corner. You can always get out. It may take time, but you can always get out. Okay, so normally, is the world ergodic? The world that you and I live in, is it ergodic? No. But we make, for example, our homes ergodic so that our kids actually go to school, you know, grow up old enough to go to school. Because with their exploration and, you know, happy exploration and lack of models combined, if the, you know, home is not ergodic, the kid won't be there. Right? Okay. So online search techniques will have, you can talk about asymptotic probability of online search reaching goal only if the domain is ergodic. If the domain is not ergodic, there's no point in talking about it. If the domain is ergodic, but your search is stupid, you may still not reach the goal state asymptotically. Then you should take the blame as a computer science guy because you wrote a bad algorithm. This version is similar to the systematic search, you know, 471 case, where if I, you know, a star search doesn't have to find a goal when there isn't a path to the goal. You can't yell at it. When there is a path to the goal, it should find the shortest path. Okay, so you normally talk about ergodic domains when you do online search. Not all domains are ergodic, but you wing it. You know, you make the domains we live in ergodic. In fact, that's the difference. This is one of the reasons why we get to be intellectually lazy. Because we, as a society, made at least the environments that we live in ergodic. Okay, remember this case, you know, every day, you know, if you read CNN, as far as CNN is concerned, you know, nothing really is happening in the world other than the craziest bad accident that happened to somebody. That would be the frontline story. And so one story that happened a couple of weeks back was this mother and her son were going to Death Valley. You know, first of all, why do you want to go there? That's a different story, but it's a nice place. And they were going to Death Valley in July, and they were using GPS. And the GPS doesn't know what the heck it is doing in the Death Valley area because the model is absent. And so first of all, at the beginning of a certain spur road, their car had a tire, you know, tire burst. So this guy, this 12-year-old kid actually apparently was way smarter than I am. So he was helping his mother to change the tire. And then they followed GPS and went into the La La Land and got stuck in a place where the car could not be removed. And this was 122 degrees, which, you know, you from Phoenix think it's a okay deal, but, you know, try staying outside. You're 122 degrees, but then you get to run into this classroom, which is only 120 degrees. But the point is, you know, we made Tempe area ergodic. Death Valley is one of the few places that's not ergodic. And the answer, you know, it's a sad story, in fact, that kid passed away, and the mother was found by a park ranger who happened to be going there 3 or 4 days later and realized that there were tire treads into this spur road, which had really shouldn't be any because only, you know, park rangers might even go there. So he went there and he found this. Now, that's a classic case where the world is normally model-free. In certain areas, we made at least ergodic. That means wherever you are, you can at least come back to a safe environment. But in other areas, you know, Everest, Death Valley, you know, you deal with it. You essentially can get into a scenario where you cannot come back. Okay. Yes, sir.
Does that mean adventure is not ergodic?
Adventure is, it depends on what kind of adventurer you are, right? I mean, I don't know, really. I mean, I think people, like my assumption, I mean, who am I? I'm not a psychologist, but my assumption is people would like to believe that things bad can happen, but at the same time, they want to believe that they will still be taken care of in the end. So, you know, Disney World mountain rides, you know, they can, if they go nice and flat, nobody gets onto them. So they should fall. But once in a while, they really fall, and people fall off of it, and then it becomes CNN frontline news again, you know. I mean, Obama might be giving speeches, who cares, but this would be frontline news because something interesting, human interest story. So again, it is connected to the fact that we make the worlds we live in ergodic. And, you know, that's a very interesting point. I mean, we change the problem. You know, only dumb people solve the problem that's given. You know as a kid, and if you have a kid, you know it in spades, that they never solve the problem you ask them to solve. They solve the problem that they can solve and convince you that you should be happy enough that they did it. Right? That's the mark of intelligence, right? And so we change the world so that hard problems don't have to be solved, unless you are silly enough to go to Mars or something. Okay. Okay. Anything else here? If you have no time to reason, you will need to do online search. That was the first thing you thought of. But these two are extra things that you need to realize. Online search can be needed in those cases too. Okay. Yeah, so trick is to use personal. Well, that's fine. Okay. So that's online search is over. Any questions on that? Okay. So now we will hopefully go faster. And we'll talk about doing belief space planning in the context of factored models. You saw this already. So the first question is, how do you define belief states in a factored scenario? And each state can be thought of as a conjunction, and union of those conjunctions becomes the belief state representation. Now, of course, you can ask yourself, how many different logical formulas can be written as disjunction of conjunctions over literals? How many can be written? All of them. That's the sad life, right? So it turns out that this is a canonical representation. If you know, if each state is a conjunction, and if you take disjunctions of those conjunctions, then essentially in the end you can write basically any arbitrary logical formula. So from the planning perspective, and here I assume that you already remember progression and regression. If you don't, since we are only 15 minutes today, when we come back by next class, make sure you read those. Okay, from the textbook, from, you know, Intro to AI textbook, for example. Okay, so we talked about CNF representation, and then belief states are sets of states. And so one of the other things is, you talk about if you have a set of anything, you might want to do this, you know, union, intersection, difference. Now the interesting thing is, all of them have logical equivalences. You know, which is, I mean, this should not be surprising for CS people, but it's still, you know, mildly interesting. So if I have S1 union S2, let's say small S1 is the logical formula for that state, belief state, okay? Then S1 union S2 is S1 conjunction S2, right? Disjunction S2. And S1 intersection S2, S1 conjunction S2. S1 minus S2, why is it M-state? No, but these states are belief states. So S1 minus S2 is what? So tell me, what is the logical formula? Come on, guys. So this is a logical, I mean, this is a big set of states minus these set of states, set theoretic difference. So I tell you that this is the logical formula that corresponds to these states. This is the logical formula corresponding to these states. What's the logical formula that corresponds to the difference? Yeah, but talk in logic. There are no intersections in logic. S1 and not S2. That's what it is. Right? So, I mean, you can't just say anything in set theory can be done in logic and just give these two, because there are other things you can do in set theory, but they can also be done in logic, right? So the interesting thing is, now you are manipulating sets by logical formulas. So we go back to propositional logic now. And so what's hard about handling logical formulas in planning? So there would be one logical formula, that's the initial state. Another logical formula, that's the goal state. Okay, for now actually let's assume that the actions themselves are deterministic for a minute. You know, of course, you can talk about non-deterministic action too. And in fact, Bryce's paper talks about a representation that is more general than what I'm going to be using here. Okay. So if I have deterministic actions, then I still have the issue that how do I project, how do I do progression, how do I do regression over full logical formulas rather than just conjunctive formulas. That's the main technical difficulty, you know, if there is one. Okay. So belief space planners have to search in the space of full propositional formulas. In contrast, classical state space planners search in the space of interpretations, essentially, because each state is completely defined, so it's an interpretation. Okay. Now, what's one difference here? Classical state space progression planners do that. It turns out regression planners already don't do that, because in regression planners, they start from the goals to get to the initial state. An interesting thing about regression is, even in the world, I mentioned this in the very beginning class, first class of the semester, even when, you know, knowing everything about initial state is a plus point, not knowing everything about the initial state is a minus point. For the goal state, on the other hand, if the goal state mentions only a few variables versus all variables, which is better? Few variables is better. That means your boss is easy to please. They really don't care what clothes you wear, how squeaky your, you know, shoes are. As long as you complete the project on time, they're happy. So you just work on that. Do you understand what I'm saying? Now, if you only have few variables, then you actually have a logical formula. It's not a full interpretation. And regression actually works on logical formulas of a certain kind. Okay? In particular, we talked about this fact that in classical planning, we talked about the fact that in classical planning, regression is working on in the space of partial conjunction. Okay, as, you know, initial state is a full conjunction. That means it says V1, V2, etc., Vn. All of their values should be given. So it's a full conjunction. Regression, on the other hand, might work V1 and not V3. That's the only thing I care. Now, what is interesting is how many, if you have n Boolean variables, there are only 2 power n such states. If you have n Boolean variables, how many of those conjunctions are there? Partial conjunctions, not full conjunctions. First of all, do you people realize that partial conjunctions are more than the full conjunctions, right? Because partial conjunctions include the full conjunctions. How many of partial conjunctions are there? 3 power n. Because each given a conjunction, a variable can be present positively, present negatively, not present at all. 3 possibilities. 3 times, 3 times, 3 times, 3 times, 3 n times. So 3 power n. Okay? 3 power n is the number of, you know, essentially logical formulas that regression searches in. Okay, so regression already doesn't do work in the space of interpretations. It does work in the space of partial states. Okay, now one interesting thing is how many possible belief state formulas should be there? How many possible full logical formulas should be there? How many, assuming, in fact, this is an interesting question. So this is only partial conjunctions. These are full conjunctions. How many propositional logical formulas are there on n variables? Assuming canonicity, assuming that two formulas which are equivalent can be seen to be equivalent. What? 2 power n. How do you reason this out? To give a logical formula of n variables, you consider V1, etc., up to Vn, and decide to, and this is the value, you decide to put true or false here. And you can, you know, count the possibilities. You can decide, you know, essentially these are the number of Boolean functions, 2 power n. And that would be the number of belief states, which is minimum, because if I give you real states S1 to Sn, how many belief states can there be? If I give you n states, then there will be 2 power n belief states. If I have m variables, I would have had 2 power m states. So I would have had 2 power m belief states. Okay. which basically, so it looks as if on one hand regression is actually doing search in the space of logical formulas, but it's not doing it in the full space of logical formulas. It is only doing it in the space of partial conjunctions. Now, what happens if I want to do that in fact, we won't talk about it today or probably in the next class, but one thing that you can do to reduce the complexity of search is to say that, yes, initial state is incomplete, but I require that the initial state must be representable as a conjunction, as a single conjunction. It could be partial conjunction, but it has to be a conjunction. That essentially means if you have n literals in a, you know, defining a state, then the only incompleteness you allow is that some of those literals' values are not known. That's it. If that's the only incompleteness you have, that means I don't know the value of the first and the 15th variable. That's it, and no more and no less. That can be easily represented as a partial conjunction because everybody else's values will be given. The ones that are left over can be true or false. Now, suppose you consider, so now if I make that kind of a restriction, you know, a representational restriction, how bad is that? How bad is that depends on what problems you want to represent. Let's take something as simple as bomb in the toilet problem. Okay, so there were two packages and they're identical looking, one of which only has a bomb. Can you write that in this form? No. Because it's no longer the case that the P, it's not that I don't know P1, I don't know P2, but P1 and P2 can't both be true at the same time. And they can't both be false either. One of them definitely has the bomb, I just don't know which one it is. So the way to write it logically is P1 or P2 has the bomb, so in bomb P1 or in bomb P2, and it's not, yeah, it's XOR. But the point is, the moment you do that, it's no longer a partial conjunction. It's not a, so in these cases, the uncertainty over, so in, to be able to write initial state as a partial conjunction, it must be the case that the uncertainty on the single variables is independent of the uncertainty on the other variables. Independent. The moment you have formulas like this, the uncertainty is correlated. And if you have the correlation, then you want to write it exactly, then you need a full logical formula. Okay? And some people do actually go ahead and essentially say, we will make the problem simple by going with, you know, if I know more, then I will still go ahead and say, oh yeah, I hear what you are saying, but I'll just say, I don't know P1, I don't know P2. And then I'll solve that problem. Sometimes that would be enough, sometimes that won't be enough. Okay? So I guess we will stop here. Next on Friday, I'll talk about, you should look at the slides that are available on the online. I actually have everything ready for the next class. We'll talk about the representations of the actions, progression, regression, handling sensing actions, all of them in planning, and then talking about heuristics, which is the rest of the Bryce paper. Okay.